This is kind of where we left off this morning. Can everybody hear me without me turning this mic? I've just got it for the webcast, but you all hear me fine, right? They are recording it, but it doesn't project it into this room. So as long as everyone can hear me, that's fine. All right, well, here's an example where we need, when what I argue we need is to at least consider the possibility that selection can be confounding phylogenetic analyses. And given that we have a hypothesis of that type, how can we approach analyzing to see if that's really a problem in a particular case? Now, I thought this service is a good example of that type of study where a particular selective pressure could potentially affect a lot of genes simultaneously. So even though it's true that in the phage studies, it's a very small confined genome, if you have a selection pressure that simultaneously affects lots of genes, then many genes could come up with the same answer that could be wrong for the same reason. And this was a case that was suggested of that type. So in this particular case, it starts off, there was a neurophysiologist, Jack Pettigrew, who looked at brains of mammals. And he suggested on the basis of looking at the neuroanatomy of mammalian brains that the megabats, the big old world fruit bats, have brains that look a lot more like primate brains than they look like microbat brains, the little echolocating bats that we're more familiar with in this country. And so he suggested that the reason was is because this neuroanatomy really suggested that the megabats were more closely related to primates than they were to microbats. So once he made that suggestion, a lot of different labs, including mine, started sequencing genes to test this idea. And there are now at least 9 different studies that have been published up till now that have investigated this problem, and every single gene disagrees with the neuroanatomy. They all suggest that the megabats and microbats are actually more closely related to each other than either is to primates. So once those data sets started appearing, Pettigrew said that argued that he thought that the neuroanatomy were still right, the neuroanatomy data were still correct, and that the reason that these genes were showing something different was because they were all convergent in a similar fashion. And specifically, he was arguing that the megabats and microbats had a high AT bias in their genomes. And that the reason that they had a high AT bias was because it was related to their metabolic rate. So they had a high metabolic rate associated with flight. And he argued, the model is sort of a little bit nebulous, but he argued that basically high metabolic rate required a high ATP content, and that changed the precursor pool available, and that for whatever reason there was this biological connection with high metabolic rate and high AT content in the genome. So whether or not you agree with the particular model, it's true that if you look at things like AT bias, that they vary tremendously in different clades of the tree of life. And so if you did have some kind of selective constraint that simultaneously changed AT bias in lots of different genes at the same time, that every one of these genes could be affected in the same way. And if it's in fact convergent in, say, two groups like microbats and megabats, then this convergence could result in lots of genes getting the same wrong answer. And so how do you investigate that possibility? So I'll just show you a couple of pictures of the players. So this is, if you're not familiar with the organisms, that's the primate there. And this is a megabat, an old world fruit bat, roosting underneath my arm.
That identification based on DNA test?
Which one, the primate or the megabat? Actually, we have, that's another story, but I could tell you a story about the analyses we did of human DNA sequences where we trying to find use our own DNA for a study of sex chromosome evolution. And there was some question about whether or not my colleague Jim Bull or not counted as a primate. But so anyway, this is the, whoops, I skipped down. This is the microbat, the Mexican fruit bat. And so Pettigrew's argument was that the megabat and I on the previous slide are more closely related to each other than either of us are to the microbat. And that the wings are a case of convergent evolution. And that indirectly, the wings being convergent with flight results in convergent evolution of the DNA sequences as well. And so that's what we're faced with trying to test. So if you just look at one of those genes, I'm not going to go through all the different genes that have been examined for this, but here's an example of one of the genes and the phylogeny. So this is the best tree over here. This is a megabat, and these are microbats, and they're placed on the tree very well removed from the primate sequences. So these are the primate sequences up here. Now, if you constrain the analysis and say, what's the best tree that supports the flying primate hypothesis, the one that puts the megabats and the primates together, then marginally, this is the tree that marginally supports that. It's supported a zero branch length, but it's the best tree that would arrange those together. So this would be the tree that would be the closest fit to the pedigree hypothesis. And of course, you have a log likelihood distance between these two. So the typical kind of analysis you do to test for the significance of whether this is a significant difference is to do a parametric bootstrap test where you're assuming that this is the correct tree, taking this tree and modeling it, and asking if this tree is right, how often would you generate data that would give you an answer like this one? And it turns out, so this is the distribution of likelihood differences you'd expect under that model. So you might expect to occasionally see a log likelihood distance of difference as large as about 4, and the observed difference is up here 70-something. So it's a much larger than what you'd expect. But that just argues that, but the other possibility, of course, that's assuming that the model of evolution is actually correct. But the second part of the pedigree hypothesis was that the reason you're getting this is because of this convergent change in the megabat lineage and the microbat lineage. And so that you can then go back and model it as well. So you can take the same kind of analysis and hold the AT bias uniform throughout the rest of the tree, and then throughout this entire portion of this branch and throughout the microbat branch lineage, we can gradually increase the AT bias so that we start off with an even ratio of 50% A's and T's to G's and C's, and then gradually increase that so that we eventually go to all changes on these branches are changes to A's and T's. And then plot out those series of simulations, plot out the relationship between percentage of AT versus the probability that you'd get the wrong model or the wrong answer given this model. So in other words, we're assuming the pedigree's tree is correct, and now we're asking what does it take to put the bat lineages together as we actually see in the real data. And as you can see, you basically never expect to see the bat tree until you get up to these really high levels of AT bias. And so parsimony is the method that's most affected by this approach. And if you had 100% AT bias, in other words, if all changes were to A's and T's on those lineages, then in fact you would expect to reconstruct the bat tree even if this were correct. But it requires certainly something more than 75% AT bias before you begin to see that effect. And in other methods, like this log debt transformation that take base composition into account, allow non-stationarity of base composition in a tree, essentially eliminate that problem, especially when you consider that you get the bat tree across multiple different genes. But you can then ask, okay, well, we need this very high level of AT bias to even experience this effect. Yeah? It means that 75% of... This would be the percentage of AT bias within changes that occur on that lineage. So in other words, all changes on this would be, if you took a look at all the changes and took the base composition of those changes into account, they would all be changes to A's and T's. Right.
So I'm not surprised that the maximum,
That stands for minimum evolution with it. So it's a distance analysis with a log debt transformation. So you have this non-stationary model that allows for base composition changes across the tree.
Yeah, that's amazing though that 100% ATUs at the end,
that is still not supported anymore. Yeah, so the log debt transformation is designed to take into account differences of base composition. So it actually seems to be extremely effective, even at these really extreme values of base composition biases.
Other problems in that tree, and those incorrect granddaughters in that tree that don't have anything to do with the question at hand might affect your control.
So, can you, maybe you can explain?
Cats would be out grouped together, you know, for example. I mean, your rooting, the didactic rooting is pretty different than what a lot of rooting cases are.
Of having marsupials as the root of the...
No. The didactic is obviously the root, but I mean, the cats is the next.
Yeah, that's actually not too. I mean, that's having carnivores outside of our continents and rodents, and I mean, that's actually not too unusual. Where would you put the carnivores otherwise?
Well,
within this group of mammals. Really.
A lot of the mitochondrial
features that way. Well, I don't know. Obviously, I haven't tested that particular part of this tree, so I can't give you an answer to that. But I didn't really think of carnivores being outside of the rest of those as being terribly unusual. But anyway, So then we can take a look at what the AT bias is actually in these lineages. So remember, the argument is that there's high AT bias in the bat lineages. And so we can ask, okay, well, where does that AT bias actually fall in the spectrum? And in fact, actually, when you look at the original data that were used to support this, it's kind of hard to see the AT bias at all in the bats. So this is a density centrifugation. So taking the whole genome of a primate, here's a human, and breaking it up into fragments. And then these different fragments that associate at different densities, the AT fragments tend to be at the low densities and the GC fragments at the high GC fragments at the higher densities. And so this was actually the figure taken from the paper that was used to say that microbats and megabats had high AT bias relative to primates. And actually, if you look at this, it seems to be just the opposite is true. If anything, the fragments that are high AT bias tend to be more the megabats and the primates. So if the bias is actually there in the genome, it would tend to favor the flying primate hypothesis rather than work against it. So in other words, the argument is that this one and this one have these high AT components that bias them to be brought together. When in fact, if there's a bias, it actually seems to be more, to me, the megabats and the primates. Well, that's a good question, which is why I thought I would just show the original figure from the paper that was cited. And I mean, this is the basis for making that argument that there's a AT bias. So, of course, the other thing you can do is look in the individual gene sequences and just evaluate them and ask, is there an AT bias? And then the flying primate, the flying DNA argument was published in Current Biology, I think. This slide? I don't remember where this came from. It was in Mammalian Genome or something like that. I've forgotten what the original paper was. So anyway, if you look at the individual sequences, it doesn't appear that the bias is there either. So in this particular case, I think it's pretty easy to argue the question is this really the right tree that places the megabats and the microbats together? And of course, we're not really answering that. What we're answering is the question, is the assertion that the reason that you're getting this tree is because of the AT bias. And I think that's at least easy to dismiss. So it may not be the right tree, but at least the alternative hypothesis that's been suggested is fairly easy to demonstrate as being incorrect. So that's going to wrap up the sort of the morning's talk now that it's 2:15. And I think I mentioned a number of these people as I was going through, but I wanted to be sure and mention other people who were involved in this. So Jim Bull is one of the individuals I worked with in collaboration, experimental evolution studies, and then Marty's our technician. Ian Molyneux in the microbiology department helped us get the phage systems working, and then Mary is a former postdoc who worked in that project. Mike Metzger, I mentioned, he's the one at Baylor College of Medicine, and David Mendel's the one at Michigan who sequenced the HIV sequences. And Paul worked with me on the Salamander project. That was the subject of his dissertation. John on the four taxon simulations, and also David Swofford. Mark Holder is a current graduate student working on the Halpern-Bruno simulations. And then Robert Baker and Ron Vandenbush worked on those monophyly of bats problems. So let me switch over to this. Yeah, I didn't go into a lot of the detail because, I mean, the detail on the local level is probably, you know, it wouldn't be terribly meaningful to tell you about which each of the spring systems that's connected. But that's actually what we did. So each of those salamanders is endemic to a very small segment of the aquifer. And so what the phylogenetic relationships of those different segments tell you is how those segments are related to each other, how those segments are connected. Yeah, it doesn't work in a linear order, so if you plot it out on geography, you find some surprises. And in some of those cases, we actually know why the surprises exist. So for instance, they're cave systems that are geographically separated, but it turns out are hydrologically connected. And the salamander relationships also indicate those kinds of relationships. So it doesn't plot out perfectly on a surface map, but as far as we know, it plots out well in terms of what's happening on underground connections. So the other thing I thought I would talk about is this issue of some of the approaches that are being taken to looking at solving these really large phylogeny problems. And this is not an example of a really large phylogeny. It's a big enough tree as to be computationally difficult. But the kinds of trees that people really would like to study now are on the order of thousands to tens of thousands of sequences. And so computationally, it's especially as we want to apply more complex models. So phylogenies of this type of viral studies are another example where we're looking at very large numbers of sequences. And we have this problem of very rapid increase in number of possible solutions. And so the computational complexity of the problems gets to be very difficult. When I showed this example on the angiosperms, I only showed results for parsimony and for neighbor joining for fairly computationally simple approaches. And that's because when I did that, there wasn't really a way to get an estimate, a maximum likelihood estimate for a data set this large in any kind of reasonable computation time. And so that's kind of one of the things that I've been interested in the last several years, is exploring ways of tackling really large problems where you want to estimate many sequences. If it turns out that looking at lots of taxa and lots of characters simultaneously is a good thing, then we need to have computational approaches to be able to analyze those. And we'd like to be able to involve these fairly complex evolutionary models. And so there's a number of approaches different people have been taking to this approach. And one of the methods that really interested me, I actually first really became familiar with when I was sitting on a panel evaluating bright upcoming young people in molecular evolution. And one of the things that we analyzed was this person who's working on an approach with genetic algorithms to genetic algorithm approach to large phylogeny problems. So my brother, who's a computer scientist, suggested a long time ago to me that genetic algorithms might be useful, and I kind of dismissed it at the time, thinking that it, after he explained it to me, thinking it wouldn't work very well. And this is another good case of where my intuition has been dead wrong. In particular, I want to talk a little bit about how really distributed parallel processing approaches combined with genetic algorithms may prove to be pretty effective for dealing with some of these really large computationally complex problems. I won't really get into talking about some of these other methods, but these are a number of the other methods that are being explored by others. Divide and conquer approaches, Tandy Warnow's disk covering methods have been proving to be quite effective at very rapidly looking at large data sets. Mike Charleston has been developing this hitchhiking algorithm. Several people working. A hitchhiking algorithm is basically, I guess I don't want to go into a great deal of detail about it, but essentially what you do is you allow solutions, you're looking at lots of, you're looking through solution space, and you take solutions that are suboptimal and allow them to be sort of carried along with more optimal solutions that are nearby. So it then allows you to sort of get off of local optima peaks later on in the analysis. So it's just a way of sort of carrying along suboptimal problems that allow you to escape off of local optima. And then, of course, the Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. I think there'll be people talking about later this week or next week. So in the generic algorithms, in a way, it seems it's surprising that, yeah. Right.
People study sort of what that is really, sort of how much signal in the data set, how much sort of coherence or consistency multiples sort of like, do you need in data set before it becomes sort of a new problem.
Yeah, there's definitely been a lot of exploration since then looking at how general that effect is. And there are certainly large phylogenies that are harder than that one. But I think in general, the large phylogenies are turning out to be a lot easier than people expected, at least in these simulated examples.
If you take that data set and then you say, you allow yourself to look at only 90%, 80%, 70% of data, at which point does it become problem?
In terms of the sequence length you're examining?
No, the
means. Oh, I see. I see what you mean. Yeah, it actually really depends on which taxa are eliminated. So, for instance, you can have a large data set problem that's very difficult if, for instance, you can create them. So you could take that same tree and make all the lineages fairly similar in length, except for two of them. And if you had two long lineages on different parts of the tree, and those are the only two long lineages, that tree would be very hard to reconstruct as well. And the reason is just because all of the noise is then correlated on those two branches, and so you'd converge to the wrong tree. So it's not... Right. So it's not just having lots of taxa alone that solves the problem. It's really being able to sort of distribute the noise across lots of different branches simultaneously that I think helps the problem, makes the problem easier.
Presumably what you've got is still a sort of subsample of a much larger.
Sure.
So if you have some idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are a few papers being published now and kind of exploring. There's obviously just a almost infinite number of ways to explore the possible tree space. But if you look at, you model different speciation models and different models for rate variation across lineages, then you have a whole spectrum of kind of ease of the problem. I would say in general, I think most people are finding that big phylogeny problems I would guess that the general consensus is most people thinking they're much easier than they would have thought they were 10 years ago. And I realize I'm not giving you a quantitative answer because I have to display some graph that I don't have with me, but there are studies like that out there now.
But beyond a certain point, probably doesn't matter, right? With this, the annual spot data set, you're already doing pretty well. If I give you 100 times more data, it's not going to help you.
Right. Yeah, so I wouldn't want to leave the impression that all big phylogeny problems are necessarily easy, because that's not true. You can certainly create ones that are hard, but in general, I think they're easier than people would have assumed they'd be.
About the details of the big phylogeny. In other words, you take four close together ones mm-hmm. in one area of the big group. Now, presumably, they're no easier.
If you're
interested in just the relationship between four close together ones, so having all the rest outside that presumably doesn't help you in that.
Actually, it does. it does end up making a difference, and for a number of reasons, including the fact that having all those other lineages helps you get a better estimate of the model of evolution, for instance. So yeah, I think it actually does make a difference, although you might still have these local effect problems where you know, still have a problem locally, that even in the large phylogeny. Does that answer? Mm-hmm. You think that's a fair assessment, David, what I said, my summary?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so the genetic algorithms are sort of a real natural way for an evolutionary biologist to think about these problems. So in a way, I'm sort of surprised that more evolutionary biologists haven't applied this type of approach. So essentially, you set the problem up so that the solutions are individuals in a population, and that the operations that you apply then to those individuals are analogous to what you'd see in the evolution of a population. And so these individuals undergo selection, and they undergo mutation and recombination, and you can also, those are the typical processes that are applied. You can also add things like drift and migration. And so finding the solution essentially becomes a process of adaptation, where you're adapting the, you're essentially selecting for a solution that fits the problem well. So the analogies here are that the genome, the analogous part to the genome is a string of information that specifies the tree topology, it specifies various parameters of the model of evolution. So this is what you're evolving. And then you're applying a mutation rate, and the mutation rate both mutates the topology of the tree, as well as the branch lengths on the tree, as well as the different parameters of within the model of evolution. So those are all the things that you're mutating. And then you allow you allow recombination among these different solutions. So you let the best ones reproduce, give more offspring, and you allow recombination among those best solutions. And then the fitness, of course, is just a function of this combination of the topology and the parameters of the model of evolution, how well the data fit. Excuse me? So this isn't really for a simulation. What you're really trying to do is take a data set and find the maximum likelihood solution for that data set for a really large problem. And the reason that it becomes a lot more computationally simple is that it's real easy to calculate this value, to calculate a likelihood value of fit to a particular tree without optimizing it. So we're not going to try to optimize the data to a tree. We're simply going to allow those characters to evolve on the tree and then select for an optimal tree through time. So let me see if this next slide will explain it. If not, you can re-ask the question. So you start off in the first generation with simply selecting a bunch of solutions at random. So we just select a tree topology at random, and then we assign links to the branches, either at random or a uniform distribution of branch links. So we'd say, okay, here's a solution, and we're going to put uniform branch links across all the different parts of the tree. And then you also can assign, excuse me? It has nothing to do with the data at this point, except that, and you also assign random values to the different parameters of the model. And now, the connection to real data is, you take a look at your real data and you say, okay, given this estimate of the evolution, given this particular tree and the given branch lengths and the models of the parameter, how well does it fit the data? And you calculate a likelihood value. Okay, so this does connect now to the data. And you've done this a number of different times, and so obviously just at random, some of these will fit the data slightly better than others will. Okay? So at the starting point, you have a lot of really bad solutions, but some of them are going to be slightly better than others. And so you now allow fitness-based reproduction. You also add in mutation and recombination. So you mutate the branch lengths, you mutate the tree topologies by rearranging the tree topology, you mutate the values of the model, the parameters for the model, and then you let the ones that the best solutions in this first generation leave more offspring to the next generation, and also you recombine elements of the best solution. So if one and three are both fairly good solutions, you allow them to recombine and leave offspring in this next generation, and then you repeat this process in the subsequent generation. And so each generation, since you're allowing the best solutions to reproduce, then your likelihood values increase through time. So you get better and better fits of the model, of the trees to the data. And obviously, if you look at the structure of this, this is very easy to parallelize. I mean, it's almost embarrassing how easy it would be, because the calculations, most of the time you're spent is you're simply taking, you're calculating this likelihood given some specified tree and tree topology and branch lengths. It's not a very hard calculation to do. You can do this pretty quickly, but that's where most of the calculations are. So if you have 10 processors and you have a population size of 10, then you can distribute these across the processors, and then they need to communicate to some extent because they have to allow the recombination and so on to pass it on. But there's a fairly small amount of communication necessary among the processors. So it's really easy to apply parallel processing approaches to this. And so in this case, the way we parallelized it is to use, so the initial, as I said, this kind of initial approach to genetic algorithms was a paper that Paul Lewis wrote. And so we kind of collaborated with Paul and developed this parallel approach and applied a single computational node, a single processor to an individual. And that allowed us to be able to look at some really large data sets and get maximum likelihood solutions. So this is based on those angiosperm, that same angiosperm tree, the 228 taxa, which I said at the time we couldn't solve other ways with using likelihood approaches. Now there's two sets of graphs, or four total graphs on here. In this black and blue one, we're plotting out the likelihood scores through time as a function of number of generations. And as you can see, what happens with either this is the simulated data and this is the real data. The likelihood scores go up extremely quickly at first, and then they begin to appear to plateau off, although they are still increasing here. This is largely because of the very rapid effect of, the very strong effect of likelihood changes, likelihood scores by branch lengths. So we start off with these uniform branch lengths, and so just by optimizing branch lengths, you make a pretty, very large jump in likelihood. And you're continuing to change tree topology as well. These other graphs show the agreement of the best solution in a given generation with the ultimate tree found, the correct tree in the case of the real data, or the most parsimonious tree in the case of the simulated data, or the highest likelihood tree in the case of the simulated data. And so you can see, even though your period of plateaued off in terms of the effect of likelihood, those small incremental changes are still having a pretty strong effect on the tree topology. And so you're increasing over time and getting this ultimate agreement with the tree. And so you can actually get, you can essentially evolve this maximum likelihood solution in fairly short order. Now this gap between the real the likelihoods of the real data and the simulated data, I think is sort of a measure of that difference of the simplicity of the data. So the fact that the simulated data are fitting the, having a higher likelihood value than the real data, I think is a measure more or less of the simplicity of our models of evolution, of how well these models are actually fitting these data sets. Yes? Yeah, actually, well, I'll show you another scale. So you're actually increasing the likelihood considerably along this portion. On an arithmetic scale, looking at it like this, you're right, you're getting the vast majority of that early on. And there's a lot of important part in here. But you're still able, I mean, there's still a large likelihood change that's going along all through this segment. I'll show a blow up of sort of this endpoint right up in this portion of the graph to make that a little clearer. So if you look here, here's the likelihood scores again at a very different scale, sort of towards the endpoint. This is plotted out in million node seconds rather than in generations now. And the reason I do this is to show, I'm really showing this for another effect. So this is the increase of likelihood you're seeing out here towards the end of these different runs. And these different runs represent different population sizes in the initial genetic algorithm. And this axis in resources is scaled in terms of node seconds. And so you're basically taking the number of processors and multiplying it times the time. And so this actually indicates sort of processor time being applied to the problem. But if you think about this in terms of wall clock time now, real time, then what this means is that this point here is taking half as much time as this point here is. Now, in terms of processor time, it's equal. You're taking half the processor time, but over twice as many processors. And so at this scale, these points are at the same point. But in terms of how much time it's taking for taking the investigator, it's half as much time by doubling the processors. And in fact, if you look at this, you're getting essentially a linear speed up in terms of the population size, at least across this scale, from 3 to 30 processors. And, well, so these are all extremely similar in terms of the point to get to, basically to get to this point. So even if you take this across back over to here, I'm talking about a difference between something like, I mean, this is a difference in, a small difference in terms of the total resource time used. So I don't know if these are really significant in terms of the order of those runs. If this is really significantly higher than that, then you're getting better than a linear speed up, right? And if this is above that, you're getting even better than linear speed up, and then you're beginning to go back down. But this is still, in other words, since you're taking into account the number of processors you're using there, then this is happening 10 times as fast. This point is 10 times as fast as this one is. And you're getting actually a better solution, right? So it's essentially a linear speed up in number of processors. Now, I don't know, we're trying to expand this now by expanding the number by using much larger architectures and trying to expand this to see how long this process continues. My guess is you don't continue to get a larger, a linear speed up indefinitely, but it does look like you can get a very rapid speed up by applying many more processors to the problem and increasing the population size. Now, there's obviously a lot of other ways to parallelize it as well, where you could parallelize the actual processes within an individual as well as across individuals and increasing the population size. But it does look like it's going to be an effective means of tackling these really large problems with fairly complex models. One of the beauties of it is that the complexity of the model is virtually independent of the time it takes you to find an answer. So since you're not trying to optimize all these different aspects of the model, you're simply taking the parameters and calculating calculating a likelihood score, then you can have much more complex models without really affecting the computation time involved in the process. So it'd be really good for complex likelihood models. For really simple things like parsimony, it actually probably isn't going to be a lot slower. So if you have a really simple method where there's very effective heuristics, then it's probably not a very effective approach.
Yeah, that thing about more complicated models is only true if the convergence time is independent of the complexity of the model. In other words, if you have a much larger search space, each move in it is the same speed. Do you have any
That's true.
Comparisons in terms of convergence time as a function of complexity?
No, I don't know that. So you're right, that's a good point. But in terms of making the calculations, what I said was true, but you're right that you may have a different very different convergence time. All right, so I wouldn't argue this is necessarily, as I said, there's a lot of approaches that people are taking now to solving these big complex phylogeny problems. So I think this one has a lot of potential. And one of the reasons I think it's useful is that one of the things I like about it is that I think there's less potential bias from the starting point. So most of the heuristics that are currently used, they start by finding a quick, simple point estimate that's a pretty good solution, and then trying to improve from there. So they do kinds of branch swappings and other things to improve from that point estimate. And the problem is that if that initial point estimate is biased, it's entrapped in some local optimum, then it's very hard to escape from that. This generic algorithm approach, one of the nice things about it is you can essentially saturate the treescape by just a bunch of random solutions. And so I think it has less of a problem with getting that entrapment, unless, of course, you're just getting the entrapment very quickly through selection. And it's also because it's so easily scalable to these larger computer architectures, I think that gets it, that's another reason I think it's a method that's worth exploring. Yeah, so this is really comparing the advantages of a generic algorithm approach to, say, more traditional approaches. But you're right, there's a lot of other new approaches that are being developed that have those same advantages. So Paul Lewis is the person who initially wrote some of the eugenic algorithms, and he's the one that we collaborated with. And then a series of grad students in my lab who worked with me on this, Matt Brower and Mark Holder and Willie Dries and Derek Zwickel. So I think with that, we have about half hour before cookies. And so why don't we open it up to any kind of discussion on any of these or other issues? Yeah, Richard.
I have a question. I can imagine that in genetic algorithms, there's this, the representation is extremely important, especially if you have sort of a linear chromosome and you're looking at the recombination. I'm just curious how you represented the trees and how you represented recombination of trees.
Yeah, do we have a whiteboard or a chalkboard
here? Yeah, there's a chalkboard in that.
Can we turn the lights up?
Yeah. Including also in terms of the recombination steps, consistency of recombination. I think this is the... Yeah. I think it's the... No.
Yeah, so the recombination is actually fairly straightforward. So if you have two solutions that you want to recombine, okay, so we want to recombine these two different solutions. So what we do is we randomly select an interior branch out of one of the two trees. So we take this one, for instance. And now we go back over to this tree, and we look at all of the tacks that are present in this branch, so A, B, C, D. And we eliminate them out of this tree. So we take off A, B, C, and D. And now we take this branch and randomly select a point on this tree to attach it to. And so now we take this and put it somewhere under this tree. And so now you end up with a tree that looks like this. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So anyway, that's the recombination. Now, obviously, there's a lot of other ways you could handle recombination, but that's the way that we did it in this particular implementation. What was the other part of your question?
Oh, well, we're just dealing with consistency, but this is fine.
Okay. And then, of course, the branches are just carried along. The branch links are carried along with it.
There's no real reason why you want to do plants and animals at the same time, because everybody knows they're different than it. You know, and if you ended up proving they were mixed together, then nobody would do that. So there's a lot of cases where you already know before you start main groups which you can divide the problem up into.
Mm-hmm.
So you
yes.
might as well just pick those groups. One argument is you just pick the groups you already know and do those separately. And then if you want the big tree, you just draw them all together at the end, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that perspective is probably what will be ended up using to reconstruct the whole tree of life, is that people do these very intensive local analyses and combine lots of them together. The problem, of course, the danger is that the knowledge that we start off with, it better be right. Because if we if we screw up at that level and we analyze, you know, we make assumptions that are wrong at that level, then they're going to carry on to the end. So I think there's a danger in it, but I think it's a pretty small danger at the level of, say, you know, I think we could probably like analyze all the mammals together, for instance, or maybe all the vertebrates, and feel pretty comfortable that they really are a clade unto themselves. And then combine that with another, you know, with other groups throughout the tree of life. But I think that we better have, you know, in order to do that approach, we have to have pretty good certainty that we're starting off with groups that really are different from each other. Right. Well, see, the ungulates is a good example. So, you know, when, you know, traditionally, mammalogists would never have doubted the existence of the ungulates. But now it looks like the ungulates are probably not a group. And so, unless you include a lot of other mammals that aren't traditionally considered ungulates, like whales, for instance. And so, you know, I think that's an example of where the approach can go wrong, where people take these groups that seem obvious to us, but in fact aren't really clades. Yeah, well, another way of people have thought about approaching that particular problem, and I don't really know how well this is going to work, but another thing people suggested you do is say, okay, well, we do this little local part of the tree very densely. We say this represents angiosperms, and here's another part of the tree here, and we've done that one, and we've done this one. You've done this for lots of different groups. Well, what you can do then is make an estimate of what the ancestral sequence there looks like. And then we do that as well for each of these other groups. And then use those as terminals in an analysis that now looks at how all these groups are related to each other. So I think that might be... Mm-hmm. So... Yeah,
I was just thinking you don't necessarily need to do everything at the same time, because you may be making life hard and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that that's... And also, it's likely that there'll be different genes that are effective for looking at different levels of the problem. So, you know, you might well want to use whole chloroplast genomes to look at plant phylogeny, for instance, and that obviously isn't going to do any good for comparing to, you know, the animals.
So I was going to say, from that diagram you just drew, would you argue that it's better to make the ancestral sequences a little bit easier, rather than, say, just take two or three from each of your two or three original sequences from each of those groups and just do a larger scale phylogeny?
I don't know the answer to that. I think this is probably worth this. I can see reasons why this might work better. I don't know if it does work better, but the reason it might work better is that you've got all this. Let's say you do have lots of rate variation within groups. You could create much more rate problems by sampling just an exemplar from within this group, rather than using all that information to go further back in time and estimate this ancestor of that group. So in other words, I think it might be better to look at, you know, if you think about the whole tree extending up that way, and you cut it back down, and now you're just addressing this part of the deep parts of the roots. So in any analysis, it's been pretty clear that the deep parts of the tree, the deeply embedded parts of the tree, are the hardest part of the tree to get right. And so if you can find a way to reduce the depth of the problem by reconstructing these ancestral sequences and analyzing those, then I think that would make sense about a way to attack the problem. Now, whether it actually works, I don't know. But I think it's worth exploring.
In a globule, you're just moving across the tree and then rearranging all those branches within a circle, for example.
But that sounds like one of the discovering methods. Is that similar? I don't know that paper. What is that?
Likelihood of using neighbor joining, both the neighbor joining tree, and I guess the likelihood to rearrange local items.
It sounds like the same kind of idea, but I'm not familiar with that paper.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I don't see that it really saves you that much from considering all of the sequences explicitly and just not allowing their relationship to vary. You know, and just in terms of the fact that since everything is hierarchical, you don't need to, it doesn't seem like this is any saving your competency.
Just fixing that part of the tree. Yeah, you might be right about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might actually, it might just be a matter of data set size of making it easier to deal with it. But you're right, in terms of the computational difficulty, it doesn't. And there may be advantages to keeping all that information in there.
Right, especially if there's very heterogeneity or things like that.
I could see that. Well, anything else? All right, well, we'll break a few minutes off.